Mr. Martin, Real Aid. I think we're now coming to the point where the preparations for going to Italy. You'd had rumours you were going. What sort of preparations were made for the trip?
We were informed that we would be moving out. We were not told exactly where, but we would be prepared to move. I think we were given about a fortnight's notice in which we would be getting organised for moving. In other words, you had to pack up everything and it had got to be transported by truck. The tanks would be going independently. So it was a case of getting the place cleaned up, sorted out, kit packed, and preparations made so that everything could be contained in lorries and moved as and when the time was notified. We had started Italian classes. Now, some chaps reckon that this was a blind, that somebody might spill the beans and, they're going to Italy. Others said, oh yes, it's a blind because we're going to Burma. But nobody knew that we started Italian classes. Not that it was very successful, actually. But we got ready, and eventually the day came and we got to move. Well, we were going from Algiers. Now, we got to get by land from Philippeville through to Algiers. And we went by way of Setif. Now, we were all in trucks, three tonners, all the kit and everything. And you can imagine the convoy, mile after mile. Tanks had gone independently by transporter. The trucks let off. And we had a night stop at a place called Setif. Just outside the city. And it was quite striking because you see the African mountains along the north coast of Africa, snow capped peaks, and it looked quite nice in the daytime. But our camp, oh, it was freezing. It was bitterly cold at night because it was everybody when we were moving. And I don't know what on earth they served us for a meal. It was disgusting. It was terrible. It tasted foul. If you can imagine the lads. They said they'd been collecting the loads of dogs. Oh, dear me. And I thought, somebody's going to be ill after this. Anyway, I didn't remember about it. We just had a bite, but I didn't know much of it. Next morning, the latrines, there was half an inch of frost on them, and they were outside, you know, boards, very primitive. Oh, dear me. Well, we set off after our supposed to be breakfast. Kept moving. And then suddenly, about, I suppose, an hour after moving, panic stations. Everybody was banging on the sides of the trucks to stop. Hold on, shouting, stop. As soon as they stopped, everybody bailed out, dashed behind trees and shrubs. It was chaos. Trucks stopped all, you talk about a convoy, they were all stopped, everybody was bailing out. It never seemed such a mess. Well, we eventually got to Algiers, but we all reckon we could have been poisoned by the food that we'd had at Setif. It was terrible, it really was. I think everybody suffered from diarrhea a couple of times on the journey to Setif and to Algiers. We got to Algiers and we just debussed from there. And we were told we were going on the Sobieski, General Sobieski, a Polish ship. So we formed our regimental groups and we went on to the Sobieski. It was absolutely crammed with troops. We slept on deck. It was absolutely jammed. I've never seen anything like it. You have meals in groups by routine, and then you went up on deck to make room for more. We had a storm going over. We were on the way to Italy. A storm that lasted a full 24 hours. The thing tossed. We nearly ran into a corvette outside our vehicle. That was interesting. We were hugging the coastline, you see, because of the danger of U-boats. We hugged the coastline, going east along the coastline, before we turned up north to go to Italy. And as we were going along, suddenly we heard the hunter going, another little heading for us was a corvette. We turned to the left, I don't know where that port of starboard. Well, of course, when you do that, the ship heels to the other side of the thing. The corvette did exactly the same, and I can remember standing on that deck in the night and looking at the mast of the corvette go past the side of our ship. It would just about straight the ship, and the thing just made it. How we landed, I don't know. I don't tell you what one of the troopers said. He could have done something on the quarter deck. But it was the nearest thing I've ever known. We pushed on and then we turned off. When we landed in Italy at Naples, and there, of course, it was a shambles. There were troops everywhere. In the harbour, there were sunken ships, and the only way we could get onto the jetty was by going over gangplanks that were fastened to the sunken ships. We went across those to get onto the jetty. We again formed up there by squadrons, and we were in regimental groups and squadron groups. And as I say, the ship was absolutely jam-packed with troops. And by the way, the food on the ship was American style food. And we formed our regimental groups into squadrons, and we marched off. We marched to a camp at Afragola. And this was a staging camp because we didn't know where we were going, other than the fact we've got to go to this camp and then we've got to spend 2 or 3 days there. We went to Afragola, and this was quite a big staging camp. We stayed there for a couple of days. There was an Italian hairdresser there, which you could pay him a few lira and get your hair cut if you wanted, and many others required it. The food was fair, but the thing I was sorry about was to see the Italian women there trying to get into the pit where we go through the tins to scrape the tins out to get food. It was tragic, it really was.
Now, when had you got to Naples, would you say? What month would that be?
That was about end of February, I would think. End of February.
So you were, that's when you were at Afragola camp, Afragola, the end of February.
A few days, yes.
And what happened next? Where were your tanks?
Tanks were coming off. They came independently on a different ship. And the lorries as well, all the transport, they came independently. And what we were doing at Afragola, we were waiting for transport. Because when the transport came, which was about 3 days later, we then got onto our transport and we were then taken to our camp at Piedmont of the Elife. That's where we had our camp before the casino. And it was there we met up with our infantry that would be joining us for the Battle of the Casino.
So you were attached to a particular unit? A particular infantry? You always were in the same unit?
Just for this occasion, just for the casino. Yeah, not after that. It was the Royal West Kent, actually.
Which battalion, do you know?
I wouldn't know.
Now, what sort of conditions were you in this camp?
Well, as far as one can be under active service conditions, they were quite pleasant. We had tents, a little bell tents, a chapter among the tents, canvas. There was a farm nearby. It was Zaffarelli, I think the farmer's name was. And there was a little farmhouse. And he provided B Squadron officers with one room upstairs as a mess, which was very nice of him. It was a rambling farmhouse. As I don't know if you know these Italian farms, there's also a family that's there, and they have a big rambling farmhouse with 7 rooms. We were given an upstairs room. We used as a mess and a planning room. The squadron leader used it for tactics, chats and things like that, and planning. And we used it as a mess. We had an Italian cook who did a bit of cooking for us from one of the local villages. The conditions were quite reasonable. What we did, we cleared roads and made them passable, and we dug ditches at the side so the water would run away. This was, I think, to keep the chaps occupied.
So working parties?
The working parties, yes. We dug ditches by the side of the roads. The tanks were all camouflaged because the Germans sent the spotter planes over.
How did you camouflage the tank?
With the camouflage nets. They spread them over trees. We were in olive groves and grape vineyards, the grapes and things like that. And we put them among the trees and spread a canvas, camouflage netting over.
Now, what sort of training did you do with the Royal West Counts?
We got them basically in groups, like platoon groups, onto a tank. Got them used to hanging onto the tank. And we did minor schemes. We couldn't do too much because we didn't want to give the Germans any inkling that we were there. As far as I can make out, the Germans were not aware of our presence in Italy for some considerable time. And it wasn't until it was nearing the time for the Battle of Cassino that we ventured to do any actual training. We looked after the tank, maintained them, taught tactics and so on, got to know the Royal West tanks, and they came over. And what we did, we fastened an ammunition bottle on the back of the tank with a headset in and a microphone. The idea being that should they be held up by a machine gun post, then one of them could ring through the handset into the tank and get the tank to fire on the machine.
Was this a telephone or a radio?
Radio. It was an extension of the wireless set. But unfortunately, because of the shelling at Cassino, many of them were blown off or shrapnel had cut into pieces by the time the chap got to them. But that was the object of them. We had them on, but not many survived, I'm afraid.
Now, any other aspects of the training that you started just before you went into action?
Yes. I was telling you about our language expert, Captain Johnson. Now, he was in our mess room beach working, and at the end of the evening, when we have a meal, he said, I'm going down to have a chat with the farmer. I'm going to try my Italian out. Well, now, the Neapolitans have got a dialect which is quite unique in Italy. Even the other Italians can't understand it very often. And Captain Johnson went down and chatted with the farmer. And he came back about an hour and a half later. Most disappointed. Almost broken-hearted. He said, they can't understand a word I say. I can't understand what they're talking about. So we put two and two together. We decided it was a dialect. He said, they use different words entirely. I use the normal Italian textbook grammar. I haven't a clue. So this went on for several nights, and eventually they began to realise the difference. And when I spoke to other Italians about his origin, the other Italian, Neapolitan, it was some peculiar dialect that they spoke. Anyway, other than that, we had quite a good relationship with the farmer and the people around. They were very helpful and produced produce for us for the mess, you see, and for the chaps they provided things. Chaps would give them a few cigarettes and they'd get some eggs and they'd cook those. The scheme of bartering was getting well advanced and they were pretty good at it. And if the chap wanted anything particular, they wanted a chicken or something like that to just change the diet, they'd barter some bully beef, you see. It worked out quite well. And they made a change of diet.
Now, you were there, you were even in this camp quite a while, weren't you? Because you didn't go into action till May.
No, that's right. We were there for quite a while.
So you were there about 2 months?
Yeah.
And what about the final preparations as you got near the time to actually go?
Well, we listened because you could hear all the time the crash of the gun. It was 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And the plane would come over, look around, go back again. Our plane would go over. And we'd get the infantry, we'd take them on the tanks. We'd do minor exercises, but as I said, we didn't do extensive ones because we didn't want to be spotted doing them. They got used to them hanging on the tanks with the full kit and all the rest of it. They knew which tank to go on, and they knew roughly what to expect when we got there. We pointed out that whatever tanks were, and most of them knew anyway, that the tanks always drew shell fire, and that was the thing that they didn't like. They were used to taking cover from machine gun bullets, but they didn't like the shell. We tried to avoid that as much as possible, but it was inevitable. The training wasn't extensive. As I say, we didn't want to be seen too much. That was the important thing. Keep undercover, we were told. And we built up to the move, and we moved bit by bit forward. We were told we were going to move, and I remember my corporal saying to me, "Well, it's time to move now. How do you feel, sir?" I said, "Well, a little bit apprehensive." "Well, you do too." He said, "Yes, you're right. I think we all do. But we don't like to admit it." But he said, "You'll get used to it." I said, "Hopefully." And so on.
How did you feel? How worried were you in yourself?
Apprehensive. Really. I had no idea what it would be like. They knew. They knew, but I didn't know. Most of them knew anyway. There were one or two new ones, obviously. But they had experienced this before. But I was a bit apprehensive. But then again, there was so much to do, so much to think about, that you couldn't think of yourself. That was the important thing. You had a troop to consider as well as to what they were going to do. And we moved up from one place to another, and we were told to be ready to move in 2 hours. And then we were given another instruction. We were going to move, and we didn't move. And then, eventually, we got the move by night. And we were moved to an area near Monte Trocchio. This was quite a high feature, conical sort of hill, which blotted us off from the battle area at Cassino. The battle started 24 hours ahead of us getting there. We were intended to go through the bridgehead that had been made. We got there in the shadow of Monte Trocchio. We were guided along lanes by the Royal Military Police, which had been cleared of mines, and there were white tapes along to show the cleared areas. And it was thick with dust. It was a dry spring, and the dust was clinging to everything.
Was that a problem in the tanks?
Yes, it was a problem. It got under your gun sights, which could be a problem. And it, of course, it covered everything else. It got dirt in the gun and so on, and everything covered with dust. We got into this area before dawn, and we couldn't see very much until dawn came, and then we found out we were in a very nice area under the reverse slope of Monte Trocchio. And we didn't know how long we'd be staying there, so we just settled down below the bottom, and brewed up some tea, of course, and had a bite to eat. And just after that, an artillery battery moved in, and they moved into the sort of a meadow below us. They dumped the guns in, and then they started firing over our heads, which was cheerful. They were firing onto Monte Cassino from behind Trocchio. Well, I thought, this is not going to last long, because the Germans have got to return the fire, which they did, of course. And there were shells going in both directions over our heads. Not that we could do anything about it. One or two landed among the gunners, and there were some casualties there. But the Germans didn't start any fires, otherwise they'd have pasted it. And the rate of fire slackened down when they didn't start any fires. The battery continued firing at a slower rate up onto the mountain. And we just sat there waiting to move. And I think we moved the next morning.
This is into the attack.
I went into the attack.
Now, did you have an O group before that?
Yes, we had an O group, and we were given our orders. Now, there had been 2 bailing bridges put across the river to enable us to get across, and one had been knocked out. The other one was the last one, known as Amazon, and that had got smoke canisters at each end so that the German observation officer couldn't see it very clearly. The smoke was blowing across the bridge, and he couldn't really see where the bridge was. It made it difficult for us to see it, of course, but then we were closer to it. We had an O group, and we were given our orders. we were to carry infantry over the bridge, and when we got to the other side, my orders were to go along the right side of a little stream until I came to a hill on the left, and then cross the stream and go up this hill. That was my orders. There was another troop on my right. I think that was three troops on my right. They were covering the right. Two troops on my left. These were our orders. The infantry on the back, and we were to carry them in. And when we got over the river, the infantry would dismount and go up independently. But when we went, squadron leader said, "You'll probably need a scissor bridge to get over. If you do, let me know." So I went along this river, a little stream actually, but the ground was marshy, it was soft. We went along. Now that we'd been instructed, I told the sergeant and the corporal what to do. And by the way, I got another sergeant on this occasion. My other chap was ill, my standard one, so I got a stand-in for this occasion. We moved along the river.
So you got across the Bailey Bridge.
The Bailey, all right, but all the heavy, some must have been 5-inch shells, threw half the stream over the tank. It really was terrific. And of course, the casualties there, they were lying there, obvious, because they had a major battle to get over the river. My sergeant, just before we got to the Bailey, I'm missing this bit out, just before we got to the Bailey, my sergeant went too near to the end of the track, and he went over the side, and he slipped the track.
You mean it came off?
Came off, yeah, and then he stayed, because he couldn't have got through, because of the whole line, the whole regiment of tanks had gone past, so there he stayed until later on. We got to the Bailey, and the smoke was a bit thick, but the shelling was terrific. The Germans were trying to destroy it, and they, fortunately, they didn't hit it. There was a chap with an infantryman with a radio on his back, lying in the ground in the grass, and he got the tourniquet on his leg. He was pointing to it as though hoping somebody would go and relieve it and help him. But I just hoped that some of our medical people would be along to help. We went over the bridge, and we went along by the river side to try and find a spot to get over, because my corporal, he knew what we got to do, but he did it without orders. He thought he could get across, he saw a spot, and I was leading, he was following a bit behind, and he thought he could get over a bit further back. And I turned round and I saw him. I said, "Hold on," he said, "I think we can cross here." And the last I saw of him was his nose going down into the stream, and there he stopped, an angle of 30 degrees. His tracks were churning and he couldn't get any grip. So I said, "I'm coming." And the squadron leader said, "You're not. Pick one, carry on, leave him." So I thought, "Oh, that's cheerful, on my own, nobody else with me." So I went on. He said, "I'm sending Charlie from another group. We'll be along with you shortly."
I should have made this clear. You only had three tanks in your troop.
Three tanks, yes.
Not four.
No, we all had three tank troops. So I had my sergeant left behind on the other side of the Bailey Bridge. My corporal was nosed down in the stream, and there he would stay, and he did stay for 24 hours. As corporal from another troop, he came and joined me, Corporal Berry, actually, and he came up, and just after he joined me, I said, "Follow me." He thought he could see a spot to go, and I said, "Turn around just in time to see him." I said, "Stop." And he tried to back out, and he couldn't. He was into the mud. So I thought, "Well, I'm not going to say anything." I just put my finger up and I backed up to him, and we got the hot. We had a steel in
there. You didn't say anything to avoid your...
His squadron leader telling me to go on independently. And I got out, put the whole rope, tow rope on, and pulled him out. We kept further away, you see, we were further ground.
But you couldn't have unditched the other one?
Not without, no. We were pulling him out, we were all right. We were fair enough on firm ground. It was the banks that were low and marshy, you see, And once you tank got into that and couldn't get his grip, well, we pulled him out, all right. And I said, don't, for heaven's sake, go near that dirt bank again. We went on, and I saw a raised portion of ground a little bit further on. And I thought, this might do. Well, I signaled him. He kept him up just behind me. And I jumped out of my tank, and he jumped out. And we looked at the ground, and it was firm. I said, this would do for the Scissors Bridge here. So I ran back to the tank, and
could you just explain what the Scissor Bridge was? I think I know, but I mean, could you tell me?
The Scissor Bridge was put onto the chassis of a Valentine, and it opened like a pair of scissors. It was hinged in the middle, and it came over and dropped on the other side. And the joint in the middle locked automatically when it went down, and it was just wide enough for a tank, and you drove over that. And it was on the chassis of a Valentine, so it could go on uneven ground. We were looking at this, and the shell landed on the other side into the soft ground. And it's time to get moving. Fortunately, it went right in. You could hear the whistle of shrapnel going past. We got into the tanks, and I said, we found a spot for the scissors. Colonel said, no use, it's been knocked out. I said, oh. He said, carry on along where you are. And just shoot at any enemy you see.
Now, that would mean turning left up the stream, would it?
Yeah, up the stream.
Because the stream was on the right of the Bailey Bridge, but you were going to go left up it.
The Bailey Bridge crossed the main river.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Now, that stream was on our left as we went over the Bailey Bridge.
Left, not left, right, yes, left. So, right.
And we went to the right hand side along the stream, you see.
Right.
Along the stream.
Upwards.
Upwards. Well, it was just a very slow incline. But the hills on the side rose more. We were in a little bit of a valley, I would call it, a little bit of a valley. And we went along this valley. My corporal then joined me after we had this escapade trying to get the Scissors Bridge up. And I said, right, we've to go along here and you stay with me. We went along and there wasn't anything. We were in a little world of our own, actually. And it seemed most peculiar. There was a great bank on the left with a couple of caves in it. And we put a shot in those, but nothing happened. And then, a bit further on, I saw two or three great-class figures that what looked like a map case, running along, trying to dodge us. On the other side, almost been about 200 or 300 yards away, across the stream. So, got a gun around to it. Always said I can see them. So we targeted it, and we fired around, and we got them. There were German officers trying to get away with a map case. And reported it back. And he said, right, carry on. So, carry on. Well, the trees were closing in us. There were some finished trees that were closing in. We were heading up this little valley. I heard some shots on the right from three troops. One of their tanks was knocked out. And we pushed on. Corporal was behind me, some distance behind. I said, you watch left and right. Make sure we're not caught in the trap. And I went on forward. And the trees were closing in.
Did they have bazookas by then?
They got bazookas.
That's what I was wondering, because that's not good territory then, wooded area.
I was afraid of. They got bazookas, and I didn't want to get into too dense a mass of trees. I looked, through the glasses, I couldn't see any sign of any infantry, but you could never be too certain. Checked, and we were firing through these trees to the left, through the caves, and at these men. And suddenly, in front of us, a Neverwerk, which fired six mortar bombs all at once, landed about 20, 30 yards ahead.
The fire from one?
Pardon?
The fire, Neverwerk fire.
Neverwerk, a fire from one gun. It fired six bombs. They all landed together about 25, 30 yards ahead. And I thought, if we go up there, we're going to be right in the thick of the trees. If we stay here, they'll be right on us next shot. I said, driver reversed. Before he could get the gun back into its forward position, the blanket box spot welded on the back was caught on a tree and it just dropped on the floor. And as we backed, you could see it lying there. My co-driver said to me, "Hold on, sir, there's some good grub in that box. We can't leave it. I'll be back in a jiffy. I'll get it." I said, "You stay there." We went back. We got back about another 20, 30 yards, I suppose. And the Neverwork fired again. And it was spot on the blanket box. When the dirt and smoke